You're listening to a classic business podcast as heard on Classic 1027. 1027.
Well, it's been a crucial week in the political economy of the buggered and beloved country, with the ANC president appearing before the State Capture Commission, defending his party's disastrous cadre deployment policies, offering platitudes of governance reform, while allowing a critical 30-day step-aside deadline to deal with corruption to slip by, while his now rogue Secretary General shows the middle finger. This, as explosive new allegations were revealed in court documents, with a jilted bidder asking the High Court to overturn the government's appointment of preferred bidders for the supply of emergency power, claiming the tender process was grossly and blatantly flawed, corrupt, and procedurally unfair. The bulk went to the Car Powership Consortium, and public sector unions are now gearing up for a fight with government and taxpayers who pay the bloated wage bill as they demand above inflation increases, while the country's debt to GDP soars towards 100%. Both events certainly challenge the reform narrative, which is a critical bellwether for much needed business confidence. This, while the world's largest economy is recovering at breakneck speed. US GDP increased at 6.4% annualized last quarter, the biggest first quarter increase in growth over there since 1984. To review the week that was, I'm joined now by Warwick Lucas, Chief Investment Officer at Galileo Asset Managers, and Raymond Parsons, Professor in the School of Business and Governance at Northwest University. Warwick, let's start with the Fed. Jay Powell is cooing away, and it's all very supportive for risk assets, it seems. What could derail this?
Michael, it's all about earnings. I think that's really the kind of behavior that we're seeing from the market is certainly confirming that craving for earnings. You'll particularly note that if we look across the indices, the likes of the Dow and S&P, relatively static in the last little while. Your more broad indices, which are more tightly aligned with the economy, the likes of your Russell 2000 and so on, reflecting a whole bunch of hopes going much higher. You can also see that in the broad class of industrial and agricultural commodities. They're all of it pointing towards a desire or hope for both stronger economy and stronger earnings following thereafter. And if those earnings fail to materialize, whether it's a policy misstep or some further wrinkle from the whole COVID debacle, then we could expect possible setbacks from the market. It does seem to be a certain element of denial in the way markets are pelting ahead, but I suppose it is what it is, and for now investors ride the tiger.
And that tiger needs to be fed, and it looks like it'll be fed by raising taxes. If you look at what President Biden was laying out, a 4 trillion rand infrastructure, jobs and social spending agenda, unprecedented in our time to see that amount of spending to be partly funded by tax increases, be it capital gains tax or others. Surely that tax noose is a big threat in terms of choking off potential future growth.
It certainly carries a lot of risk with it. How much will wealthy Americans actually tolerate? Now, at the moment, of course, American citizens are subject to global tax. So even if they decide, well, to heck with this, and they emigrate, they're still technically liable for tax unless they actually chuck in their citizenship. So from that point of view, the US IRS is quite sticky on its citizens. Nevertheless, the kind of person that they are looking to tax, and indeed those in the top quartile, say, certainly do have means of mobility, and they certainly do run risk that in the longer term those taxpayers could go cold and disappear, or be disincentivized in other ways. And we saw that when France experimented with massive taxation in the last decade or so. Initially, they got lots of money, and then it backfired.
And it's a global phenomenon. We've been discussing the last few weeks, Raymond, the rise of inequality post the pandemic and the haves versus the have-nots and how governments around the world are going to respond. Just this week, we had news that the Lee family of the famous Chibol that created Samsung over in South Korea has been slapped with a $10.7 billion inheritance tax bill. They're now selling off famous artworks, some Dalis and Picassos in there, in order to soften the impact. But this has surely got to be one of the key threats to global growth from here.
Yes, I think we'll have to see where the chips fall. As you say, it is a global phenomenon, which means that it's rather fragmented. It's not as if it's a coordinated from the center over the board decision on where some of these taxes will go. I would just enter the caveat, Michael, in regard to the US situation. We keep talking about it as if it's the Westminster model of decision making, that a government decides something and the chances are pretty good that it's going to happen. It'll go through Parliament. That this is going to be subject to an intensive congressional process. It's going to go through a lot of panel beating, and I suspect the fact that a lot of the markets in the states are laid back is because they know that. They know that by the time it comes out at the other end, it's going to be considerably nuanced and much more realistic in terms of whatever tax increases they want to make in the states. So I think we've just got to watch the process and see to what extent it gets mauled through the Congress. It will go through, but even some of the Democrats are not entirely happy with the degree of the proposals. So I think we must sit back and see what tax compromises will emerge in the United States eventually.
Let's move now to the other big story of the week locally, and that was obviously the president appearing in his capacity as the former chairman of the ANC's Cadre Deployment Committee between the years 2013 and 2017, and as the ANC president before he appears as the president of the country. And an important distinction here, because he was really being grilled about the ANC's role in state capture, and Judge Zondo quizzed him on whether or not, you know, he knew. And really what stood out for me was a very simple question under oath yesterday. When did you realize that corruption was becoming a severe problem in the ANC? And the president said, well, he'll need a few days to prepare an answer. I mean, what did you make of the performance over the last few days, Raymond?
Well, I think we must just emphasize, as you indicated, that there are two sessions. There is this particular session which dealt with the president of the ANC in that role. And then next month, we're going to see the other section where our president will appear in his role as the state president. So that's when the other shoe will drop, and we must look out for that. But on the positive side, and I think we must see also the positive side here, this was good optics. I think it was good for South Africa and good for South Africa's governance in the future for a president to be seen to appear before a commission of inquiry willingly. In the case of the tale of two presidents, this is obviously the better one, to be prepared to answer questions and to give his version of what's been happening within his political party and how it might affect the country. So the fact that the president is willing to submit himself to a judicial process and provide an overview of his party's political structures and their processes, the mandates and so forth. And he had, of course, in that capacity, steer a middle course between what I'd call the mea culpa and the unity within his party. And from, I think, he is politically astute enough to have steered that course quite well. But there is a downside, because there are wider considerations about good governance which emerged. And you've already touched on one of them, that there are issues that were embedded in the party political processes, which he spoke about in general, which led to a permissive environment in which a whole lot of things went, as he put it, horribly wrong. So we're still waiting some of the details, but I would say, as much as I am interested in what the Zondo Commission is revealing, we are looking into the rear vision mirror because we want to know exactly what happened. But I think we're starting to get much closer to the point of what do we do in the future to prevent this kind of thing from happening. I just want to make three points that came to me already after the 2 days. The first is that with the benefit of hindsight, it's clear now that a president in South Africa has too much power. There were good reasons for that originally. We probably thought that we would always have a Mandela-like president forever. I think that's one area that indeed Zondo has to address. The second is, understandably, we are preoccupied with wanting to have a developmental state. But quite clearly, many of these things that have gone wrong have been spawned by the way the development state has been implemented. The fact that open-ended, in fact, micro-intervention discretionary powers have encouraged a whole climate of state capture and corruption. And the third is, it's also already clear, even before the second session, that the two centers of power, i.e. the Union Buildings and Luthuli House, have been a source of enormous uncertainty. And now I can understand why our policy uncertainty index is always in its negative territory, because there's this undercurrent of the way the decisions are taken or delayed, or indeed the inner contradictions in economic policy not resolved because of the nature of these party political structures that I think must be addressed by Zondo. So I think it's not just a question of Zondo looking from a technical point of view, how were certain institutions hollowed out, how can we improve the checks and balances, which we need to do, which are already clear. But I think you need to look at some fundamental issues. What is it structurally that is creating a permissive environment? And if you do not get that right, you will get a recurrence of what has been revealed so far by the Zondo Commission, and in particular by the responses of the president in the past 2 days.
And one of the big issues is clearly cadre deployment. Warwick, what did you make of the 2 day interrogation and the quality of decision making and the accountability or lack thereof?
Okay, so I think this builds nicely on what Raymond was saying. I mean, you know, the difficulty with the ANC coming out from the Zuma era was, of course, anyone who was going to replace Zuma had to come from the inner circle. And there's an old saying that if you sleep where the dogs lie, you will wake up with some fleas. So I think virtually anyone in the ANC is going to have one or two flea bites on them. But the issue with cadre deployment, and it's a matter that Raymond and I have both banged on about on your shows in the past, Michael, but it really was a massive conflict of interest. And the key issue now is, how will the ANC and government collectively and separately institute a culture of compliance and the introduction of a proper compliance structure? Mm. How many and how competent are the compliance officers in government? And I bet if you had a good dig, you'd probably find it's exceptionally weak deliberately. I mean, after all, the whole approach of Zuma's government was that if you had enough princelings running around somewhat misbehaving, that would basically provide cover for the kings. And that is the whole toxic swill that you have to sift out and completely restructure. So in terms of cadre deployment, there will be some that are competent. There will be lots that are not. And again, it goes back to an old question of ours. How do you performance manage this lot in government?
Raymond, the other big issue is the key wage negotiations between government and the public sector unions. And just as context, there was a big dispute around year three of that three-year wage agreement that was agreed to back in 2018. Government dug in its heels, said it can't agree to what was agreed between government and the unions in that third year. And it went all the way to the Labour Appeal Court. The public sector unions lost. They're now taking it all the way to the Constitutional Court, but they've subsequently entered into new and fresh wage negotiations. They've stalemated and deadlocked again, and you've got the Public Service Minister, Senjo Mchunu, calling on solutions from the public. What solutions might we bring to bear on this impasse that will see or at least try and avoid a strike, which would be hugely damaging in the current economic environment?
Well, Michael, I think, as you rightly say, this is an issue that needs to be unpacked in the public interest because it's still a big-ticket item. It arises from the budget and things that were said before the budget. in our fiscal scenario, we simply have to get this right. At the moment, it looks, as you rightly say, like a zero-sum game, either 0% or 7%. And those seem to be the sort of two alternatives. But there are still some tough negotiations that have to be undertaken legally. In other words, there's not going to be a strike in 2 or 3 days' time. There's still scope for further negotiation, try and get reconciliation. Then you've got to get a strike certificate and so forth. So there's still some way to go, and there's still an opportunity to look at what are the trade-offs here. Now, you'll recall that someone well known to us, and that is Milton Friedman, once said there's no such thing as a free lunch. So there's no free lunch here. Whatever you decide, whether it's the total wage bill or the fringe benefits, they will have to be subject to a process of negotiation. There will be trade-offs, because the government will put its case on the grounds of what it can afford, what the country can afford. And on the other hand, you'll have the union saying what they think on the grounds of equity is necessary. So I think what's important here is it's important that there are inputs from various groups, because quite clearly you don't want this to end up in an impasse. As you rightly say, we are in an economically still vulnerable position. We can do without a sort of national strike of the public sector. We know also that the credit rating agencies are watching this process. What will be the outcome? How strong will the government stand on this matter? And in the meantime, since this process has started, we're now in an election year. So what does that inject into the dynamic, both on the side of the public unions and on the side of the government? So I think what's important here is that we must use the time and the processes available here to try and avoid a zero-sum game, because not only will the country lose, but our economy will lose if we don't resolve it. And I think the important point now is to say there are ideas coming to the table. It will call for a degree of flexibility, accepting that the government has fiscally got its back to the wall. But there are, we know that that's what negotiations are about. If one could reach something of a compromise that will, on the one hand, placate, in fact, the unions, that will be willing to accept in the national interest, they must settle for much less. And on the other hand, the government will find some room to maneuver. But bearing in mind that the overarching architecture is one of a trade-off, and that there's no free lunch here.
And within that, I found it interesting, tactically, that the Public Service and Administration Minister would invite comment from the public, almost to defuse some of that potential public sympathy that the unions might think that they would receive if they were to embark on a strike. In fact, in an environment, Warwick, such as we've just had through COVID, where people in the private sector have lost jobs, have had salary cuts and bonuses frozen and that kind of thing, where you haven't seen the concomitant loss of jobs in the public sector, I don't know how much sympathy there would be. But I think most people would agree that to borrow money that you can't pay back for current expenditure is a fast track to insolvency. So what is it that the unions can't understand about this?
Well, Michael, they've never really understood. This has been a long, slow-burning problem. If we consider where salaries have gone, I would say that government salaries have probably in the last 20-odd years risen more or less 50% in real terms. So that's those real increases slowly compounded up to a big unaffordable problem. So let's take the example of teachers. Yes, they're not hugely well paid, but if you consider something like a school governing board or private teacher, they would typically be paid between 20 and 70-80% less than a government-appointed teacher, for example. So the disparity in salaries between government and market in places has become more and more untenable, and it's basically then led us to a position where suddenly the government has got its hands in its pockets and it's struggling to even find the coppers. And the unions, in no small part, have paid a big part in this whole rising problem. they are quite correct when they point towards government and say, your corruption is not our problem. You were rotten managers, etc., etc. Full marks. But that actually is a separate issue.
Mm.
The point is this. We've now come to a Waterloo. Do we fight to win, or do we just simply run around parading? What do we do?
If I could just come in quickly, Michael, and say, I think one dimension which must now be injected more than ever before, if you want to find some answers or trade-off, must be productivity in the public sector.
Mm.
We need a searching and intensive unpacking of the levels of indeed productivity in the public sector, because in a way you can say it's unfair to say one size fits all. In fact, there are highly productive members in the public sector who ought to be rewarded. But I think you now need to inject the productivity dimension in helping to find the right trade-off that will give us the best outcome for this dispute.
And that is a big issue, because for the longest time, SATU and the teachers' unions have resisted the introduction of standardized national tests below matric, the annual national assessment, for fear that these might evolve into a mechanism for performance-related pay. They've resisted technologies to track time and attendance, as well as even the mundane oversight of school inspectors. So this is a conversation that must be had, but we also need to peel away this veneer that the public sector unions are using to point the finger at government and say, well, there's corruption. So we don't want to talk about the public sector wage bill and the size of the wage bill. Yes, we need to address corruption, but we also have to address productivity and what a productivity review might look like. And Busa, along with Intellidex, produced an excellent report on this towards the back end of last year. So I'd encourage the Public Service and Administration Minister to lean on business's contribution. Business is trying to assist government here in coming up with a workable solution. And I just want to come back, Warwick, to your comment about teachers' salaries. Measured in purchasing power adjusted US dollars, they're nearly 50% higher than the OECD average. Here in South Africa. And you've got to ask yourself, and that's according to the Busa Intellidex research, what are we getting in terms of bang for buck if we are paying over the average at an OECD level? And I think quite clearly, if you look at the skills gaps and the outcomes in the public sector, we're not getting what we should get. Maybe it's because, Raymond, we've got too many public sector or public holidays in the country. I mean, we've just finished a month. We've got fortunately May Day falling on a Saturday, so there's no public holiday for that. But we always on holiday. It's interminable. We just can't get any work done.
Well, let me say this, Michael, that if we look at it globally, we are among the highest of the countries in the world, along with Japan and the United States, with a number of our public holidays. This is a soft subject in our public policy debate, and there are sensitive cultural and religious factors involved. So I don't want to lecture people about the work ethic and indeed productivity on this matter, except to say that we could rationalize it a lot more than we do at the moment. And I just want to remind us, those who have got a memory going back to as far as 1994, that the new government actually promised, among other things, that they would rationalize public holidays. But I think that's rather fallen off the table. So I think what we need to just look at, perhaps from the point of view of rationalizing where we are with our current public holidays, is that other than the religious holidays, couldn't public holidays always fall on a Monday and avoid midweek disruption? This midweek disruption, I think, is quite a high economic cost for our economy. And then, is it necessary that now, today, that holidays that fall on a Sunday now get transferred to the Monday? I mean, what is the rationale behind that? I don't know what the original rationale was, but what is the rationale? And then finally, I might say, in a topical way, although it doesn't relate specifically to a public holiday, but when we have elections, why do we have it on a Wednesday? Why not have it on a Saturday or Sunday? I mean, there are many countries that have weekend elections. So all I'm saying is I don't want to undo the balance between work and leisure. I think I don't want to be an Uncle Scrooge here. I think people must enjoy their leisure, enjoy their public holidays. But I think we could have a better balance between productivity and leisure if we reviewed how we can streamline the number of public holidays that we have and to make them more effective from an economic point of view as well as from a leisure point of view.
Well, it certainly feeds into the whole conversation around productivity and just doing more with what you have rather than actually pulling anything off the table. Raymond Parsons, professor in the School of Business and Governance at Northwest University, and Warwick Lucas, chief investment officer at Galileo Asset Managers, with your Week in Review.